now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauk.
Good evening, everyone, or good afternoon, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, reclaiming that which has always been in you. In fact, finding the courage to be able to reclaim that which has always been in you. Thank you for joining me today. These broadcasts, by the way, just focus on the integration of spirituality and mental health within the context of our relationships with ourselves and others, God and the divine. And it is my great pleasure to be with you here today and every Tuesday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time. I'm Dr. James Hauk, and if you'd like more information about me or to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I always enjoy reading the comments. Please visit me at www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And actually, I have some good news to share with you. Earlier this week, happy to report that now these shows will be podcasted, and you can access them through Apple iTunes Store. You can download them there, and I'm sure there will be a link on the website for you to go in and just click on that. And wherever you are, you will be able to listen to the show, or if you've missed any at all, a portion of these shows, you can go back and listen to them. And I do really, really appreciate that. And for tonight, if you would like to be part of the show, if you would really like to call in, please do. The number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I have enjoyed the phone calls and people have called in previous shows. Great conversation, and I encourage you to do so. And I will be taking your calls in the second half of the show today. And I always enjoy when you call into the show because I always want to know what's on your heart today, especially today's subject, healing from self-inflicted wounds. It's maybe not a popular subject, but it's a necessary subject because many people often go through life just questioning how they can get through or how they can survive or how can they even possibly heal? When will they heal? Why won't they heal? And other things. But we often find that we are our own worst enemies. And so what do we do when we heal, or how we heal from these self-inflicted wounds, the wounds that we do without ever realizing it, the ones that we do to ourselves. So I hope that wherever you are today, you are safe, you are at peace. And just a quick word before we get into this topic of self-inflicted wounds, just a quick word about next week's show, July 14th, entitled Change Equals Loss Equals Grief. Change equals loss equals grief. And that's a very special show because I will share with you a very important teacher in my life who taught me that mantra about how even the slightest changes in our lives affect us on a physical level, an emotional level, psychological level, and even a spiritual level. And if we don't pay attention to these changes and realize that they do kick up a sense of loss in us, a loss of what we once knew, a loss of the familiar, however we want to look at it, as loss. And whenever there is a change, there's going to be that sense of loss. And wherever there is a sense of loss, there's going to be a sense of grief. And this is something that we all need to pay attention to, just in terms of our mental health and just how we go through life and we don't realize how things build up until we are faced with that very big loss of a loved one. And it seems like all the little losses in our lives just come crashing in at once because we have not been taking care of ourselves. So anyway, that is next week's topic. I won't share too much more about that, but invite you to tune in then. Change equals loss equals grief. Well, welcome to July. Here we are. In fact, here we are on 7/7/20 at 7 o'clock in the evening, Eastern Standard Time, of course, which is kind of auspicious with all the sevens aligning here. It's just kind of ironic the way things have occurred. But I hope that you had a safe and fun holiday weekend. I'm always kind of cautious around the 4th of July weekend because being in the mental health field, unfortunately, that's kind of a time in which can be very stressful for first responders, especially people who work in the emergency room, because that statistic holds up time and time again, that whenever you have fireworks and alcohol, not a good combination. And so ERs are often the busiest on 4th of July for that, for those reasons. So anyway, but I hope your 4th of July was safe and that you had fun. And I hope that you are social distancing. Okay. Well, let's begin tonight. Let's get into this subject of healing from self-inflicted wounds. If you recall, if you tuned in a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about how often we receive our deepest emotional, psychological, physical, spiritual wounds as a result of being in relationships with one another. You know, whether the wounding was intentional or accidental, it's often what we do afterwards, after we've been wounded, or that we have wounded another person that will either reinforce those wounds or find a way to be healed and to be free from those burdens. In fact, the irony is that in order to find our healing, we need to be in healthier relationships in order to heal from damaged emotions and wounded spirits and lack of emotional or psychological support. And it's kind of, you know, the irony of life. We receive these wounds in relationships to others, but we can't get out of relationships, so to speak, because we're social beings. But we often find our greatest healing comes from being in healthier relationships. But how do we get there? You know, it's not just something nice to consider because we write it down on paper or we've read it into a book, but the practical, just how do we do this? Okay, well, I have to share with you that as a counseling educator and a clinician and a pastoral professional, I'm often saddened by people's beliefs that when it comes to addressing their physical, their emotional, their spiritual problems, they often consider themselves powerless and without a voice. And this doesn't occur, you know, just out of the blue. It's perhaps as a result of never feeling valued in the first place, or they were never allowed to use their voice, or perhaps metaphorically speaking, their voice was taken away due to something traumatic that was never been able to put into words, never allowed to be expressed. Well, admittedly, many people are unable to perceive their insights and their strengths as if they cannot see themselves capable of healing, let alone achieving anything meaningful with their lives. I hope those of you who turned in last week that you went on the website, the Values in Action Survey, or I think it's viacharacter.org is actually the website where you can go and you can take the assessment, the test, to learn of your positive character strengths, those things that you already come into this world with, those things that you rely on. Perhaps you've forgotten that you have these certain qualities or these character traits, and you have all of them. It's just a matter of how you score on the test and how they are ranked as to which ones that you use more often than others. But you have all of those 24 character strengths. So I hope that if you haven't done that already, that you would go and visit that website. It is just fascinating to find the results. And just one more thing for us to realize that we are truly indeed gifted when we come into this world, that we are not without our resources, that we have been blessed, and that blessing is not just for ourselves, but perhaps more importantly for other people, so that they can find their healing as well. Well, as I said, many people are just unable to perceive their insights and their strengths, and therefore they might consider themselves just incapable of healing. They just might struggle with, I can't find any meaning and purpose in my life. Because most of the time, I think people are content to live for these brief moments of joy and celebration, you know, marked off by transitional milestones of, let's say, baptisms or marriages, birthdays, graduations, promotions, retirements, etc., etc. Well, furthermore, when it comes to really wrestling with and struggling with life's questions, many people are often overwhelmed not only by the concept that the answers they seek often lie within themselves, but also there's this belief that inner freedom and peace and joy and unconditional love are just simply too good to be true, that those things belong to somebody else, that how in the world can I be worthy and deserving of such very, very precious gifts? Well, here's a good example of what I mean. I run into this in counseling clients all the time. One of the major psychosocial spiritual obstacles, as it were, that I run into occurs when emotionally or psychologically wounded people are genuinely frightened and they're genuinely immobilized by their potential for healing and inner growth. See, failure is not the only thing that people fear. For the longest time, it used to be, well, people are afraid of failure, and that's true, some people are. But I tell you, a lot more people are afraid of success, however they would want to define success. This idea of finding inner peace and freedom is just too good to be true, and therefore it's immobilizing. They just feel it's not for them. I remember working with a woman whose husband had died after 30 years of marriage. And indeed, she was, you know, truly grief-stricken and clearly struggling with severe depression. And we took our time. I allowed her to get her story out. I encouraged her, you know, tell me how you two met. How did you fall in love? What were some of the most, arguments that you two had? What were the little things that he did that would get on your nerves and vice versa? You know, the good stuff that you find in a marriage. That's just part of this woven fabric that we call the stories in a marriage. And as we continued to work together, the more of her story and pain and loss started to come out in more and more detail. Yet there was one time that we met when she started to get a glimpse of a healthier life, and she immediately said to me, stop, I can't do this anymore. Don't take my grief away. Now, I knew where a statement like that was coming from, and not that I could ever take away something that another person wasn't ready to let go of. But she would rather live in her grief and pain and sorrow than embrace the possibility that she could live a life, all the while being able to hold on to the wonderful memories that she had of her husband. In her mind, if she let go of her grief, she would be letting go of him. If she let go of her grief, she had nothing else better to take on. Well, as we all explore our painful memories, we often catch a glimpse of what healing and wholeness just might look for us. When this insight occurs, we may be tempted to resist that change or run away from transformation, or even sabotage ourselves by falling back into those old ways in order to avoid embracing what thorough healing requires of us. And perhaps that means we need to acknowledge some wrongdoing on our part. Maybe that means that we need to ask for or receive forgiveness. Or maybe we need to let go of bitterness or resentment. Maybe we need to take on responsibility or live in gratitude, whatever the case is. But even when an opportunity to forgive and reconcile with one who has caused us great pain and suffering, and vice versa. Maybe we've caused that pain and suffering in somebody else's life. Because whenever that opportunity is presented, because, let's say, bitterness has so entangled our soul, it's often impossible to let go of that pain, to let go of that offense. In fact, we might even believe that to let go of that bitterness, that's a true sign of weakness. And we just can't go there, because what will other people think of us? Well, all in all, sometimes both the victim, survivor, and offenders cannot envision taking hold of something better. It's just too vulnerable a place for them to go. And let's be honest, although each person walks his or her own path, embracing forgiveness, healing, grace, and love occurs as each person is ready. Nobody can do this for anybody else. In other words, the door of healing can be shown, but one must turn the key and walk through. This is something that we have to do individually. But something else that I've noticed in people who struggle with transformation and change and get a glimpse of the healing and what that entails for them is that there's this strong connection between the perception of fear of change and perceived powerlessness and a lifetime of struggling with perhaps self-loathing and low to no self-esteem. Perhaps through various hurtful experiences, people have internalized society's definition of them that they're dirty, or that they're worthless, or that they have no voice, or that they're dispensable. Nobody would miss them, that they're no good, that they're backward, that they will amount to nothing, whatever it is. And although it's difficult to say when people started to internalize such messages, it's often easier to perhaps pinpoint from whom these messages came. Maybe you've heard such things from parents or teachers or other authority figures, or maybe friends, or perhaps these messages were even reinforced by society. And certainly history has demonstrated that society often holds out an ever-changing measuring stick that has one standard for the so-called powerful and privileged, and another measuring stick for the weakened and the wounded. And this is something you don't have to go too far back in history to find. The weak and the wounded, the most vulnerable among us, even ourselves? Why two standards? Well, nevertheless, regardless of its place in history, there seems to be this continuous pattern of this interpersonal indignity and humiliation for people who have yet to realize their truth and have been convinced that the only way to know and describe themselves is to settle on society's definition and mistreatment of them. And unfortunately, for some wounded people, that is enough to settle for. It's just too painful. Back in 1964, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the SNCC, showed up in Selma, Alabama, and they were met with violence and intimidation by then Sheriff Jim Clark, who waited at the entrance of the county courthouse, and he was beating, arresting people who wanted to register to vote. And as I said, he was beating and arresting them even at the slightest provocation. And at one point, Clark himself arrested around 300 students who were holding a silent protest outside the courthouse, and then with his deputies, force marched them with cattle prods to a detention center 3 miles away. Later that day, Sheriff Clark was punched in the jaw and knocked down by one demonstrator, Annie Lee Cooper, whom he was trying to make go home by poking her in the neck and poking her in the chest with a cattle prod after she had stood for hours at the courthouse in an attempt to be one of these who wanted to register to vote. Well, sometime later, I think it was in like a within a year later, there's a debate that had occurred between William F. Buckley and James Baldwin at Cambridge University. James Baldwin was a writer, a playwright, a poet, an activist, and you can access that debate on YouTube. It's, you know, in black and white, and actually the sound is pretty good. And Baldwin makes an interesting case about what happened in Selma, Alabama. He says, "Sheriff Clark in Selma, Alabama, really cannot be dismissed as a total monster. I'm sure he loves his wife and children, and he even may like to get drunk. One has to assume that he is a man like me, but he does not know what drives him to use the club, or to menace with a gun, or to use the cattle prod. Something awful must have happened to a human being to be able to put a cattle prod against a woman's breast. Indeed, what happens to the woman is ghastly. But what happens to the man who does it is in some ways much, much worse." As you watch that YouTube video, you can see that those who were in attendance for that debate listened to these words, and in this one point, Baldwin reminded them that the offender, the oppressor, often suffers a greater tragedy of inner pain than one who suffers, let's say, outwardly. Now, I'm not dismissing the pain and horrific suffering experienced by victims, by no means. And we should, as a society, work to stop any kind of psychological or emotional or physical or even spiritual wounding, any kind of violence in any form, anything that people commit, against one another. And I'm not encouraging any wounded person to become a doormat, as it were, that allows others to wipe their feet off of them with their betrayals and lies and deceits, and physical and sexual and emotional abuse, murder, violence, and cruelty. No one is a doormat. But what James Baldwin was saying to us, especially for us to consider even today, is that what must have happened in that person's life? What level of pain did they have, their own suffering, their own sorrow, that has so seared their painful, traumatic experiences into their emotions that they're able to commit such violence acts against one another and not blink an eye, walk away, maybe even sleep soundly that night? When you think about it, what is the depth of another's scarred soul that allows them to do this? This is an even greater tragedy. And until their pain is healed, they will more likely continue to wound others, consciously or even unconsciously. And this scarring is not limited to those who commit physical violence. There are plenty of people out there who use their psychological, emotional, and spiritual wounds to continue their need to control others, or to intimidate others, or to guilt trip others. Some use economic abuse, some use coercion, some use threats, some shift blame, etc., etc. We don't realize what we're doing, because perhaps we never stop to consider, where did it all come from? How did it all get started? From where in the depths of our soul is that bubbling up? And what wounds are festering that appear outwardly in acts of violence? If you're a fan of the rock band Eagles, they have a great line that when I first heard it decades ago, it always stayed with me. And I use it in counseling therapy all the time to get my point across, and it's this: how often do we live our lives in chains and we never know we have the key. How often do we live our lives in change and we just never realize we have the key? And this is where the term psychological self-inflicted wounds come from, the emotional psychological self-inflicted wounds. Because when it comes right down to it, we are our own worst enemies. Now think about, you know, these self-inflicted wounds this way. We think that if we would say something harmful or do something harmful, that it's never going to come back on us. But it does. Every negative thought, every negative thing we say, every negative thing we do comes back to us, often reinforcing the most wounded parts of ourselves. And we as a society have many ways to describe this concept. We say things like, well, what goes around comes around. What you sow, you will reap. And even understanding karma, you know, is another way to understand that no matter how you say it, in a sense, humanity lives in an echo. That whatever goes out from us will return to us, just like we hear the sound of our own voice echoing back in our ears when we're in a tunnel. Everything that we think and say and do is energy. And unless we transform that energy through healing our own wounds, it will come back to us exactly how it went out from us. And as I said, this is a phenomenon that I run into in counseling situations all the time. People want to heal from their past and improve their relationships. And it's like when we start digging into that and we start listening to their story and we start exploring some things, you know, a lot of people don't like what they start to see. It is a very, very painful process. But when they catch a glimpse of the potential of their healing, some people are drawn to that, and some people are not. Whatever a person is struggling with from other relationships, more than likely, they're struggling with the same issue in themselves. What negative energy is being sent out echoes back sooner or later. Let me give you an example here. A person who is filled with bitterness from, let's say, a previous hurt or a betrayal will more than likely view everything and feel everything from a lens of bitterness. A person who has experienced tremendous hurt from broken trust in relationships, excuse me, unless that's healed or transformed, it more than likely will view everything and everyone with suspicion. This is very difficult for people to understand about the phenomena of emotional and psychological self-inflicted wounds. What goes out has first come from within. Sometimes a person might say, I'll never forgive that person for, which usually translates as, I'll never be able to forgive myself. Or one person might say, I can never trust another person because he, which usually translates into, I have difficulty trusting myself. Or another person yet can even say, I can't stand it when a person says or does this. Again, often translates into, I can't stand myself when I say or do this. And for a person who says, I just can't love that person because, usually means, I also struggle with loving myself. How we are with others is often how we are with ourselves and vice versa. How we see ourselves is often how we see others. Unresolved and unhealed wounds distort how we view and interact with the world. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, I would really love to hear your heart on these matters. So again, if you would like to call in, the number is 800-627-6008. Again, 800-627-6008. And I'll be back taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. Be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, just a quick word about next week's show. I invite you to tune in. Change equals loss equals grief. We're going to be taking a look at how often different changes in our lives will stir up a sense of loss. And wherever there is a sense of loss in our lives, there is going to be a sense of grief that we need to pay attention to, because first and foremost, it will show up in us physically, then emotionally, psychologically, and so forth. So that is next week's show. Change equals loss equals grief. Well, earlier, as I said, at the top of the hour, we've been talking about a different way of how to look at how we might find healing when another person wounds us emotionally or psychologically or physically or even spiritually. And a key piece of healing for us is to first perhaps seek to understand what must have happened in another person's life, their own pain, their own suffering, their own sorrow, that perpetuates their need to wound others. And indeed, this is something that we need to ask ourselves. What are those things that have so wounded us that allows us to continually act out of our own woundedness in relationships, but yet at the same time, we expect different results? And then we wonder why we don't heal. Indeed, how we are with others is often how we are with ourselves and vice versa. And how we see others is often how we see ourselves. Unresolved, unhealed wounds distort how we view and interact with the world. I wonder how many of you out there had seen the movie Frozen. Yeah, I know that Frozen 2 is out there. I think they're both now available on Netflix or Amazon Prime or something, but yeah. And of course, the tunes, which I won't start singing because then you'll never get that out of your head. But it's a wonderful story. But how many of you realize that the movie is actually a variation of Hans Christian Andersen's children's story, The Snow Princess? He wrote that back in 1845, and it just had many variations down through the decades. But in the original story, Andersen, the main character, is this evil troll, or AKA the devil. And the devil uses a very large magic mirror, kind of like the funhouse mirrors that you see in carnivals. And he uses this mirror to distort the appearance of everything that it reflects. In fact, the mirror wasn't even designed to reflect the wholesome and beautiful aspects of people and things, but instead, it only magnified their ugly and wicked characteristics. And throughout this story, the troll becomes amused in distorting the images of everyone and everything to the degree that even the most beautiful lands, when you look at them through this mirror, they look like boiled spinach. Well, one day, this troll, the devil, decides, with the help of his minions, to carry this mirror into heaven so that he might make fools of the angels and God. However, the mirror slips from his grasp and falls back to Earth and shatters into a billion pieces. And these tiny shards of mirror are then blown all over the place by the wind, all over the Earth, which get into people's eyes and hearts. And as a result, people's hearts become frozen, like ice. And their eyes can now only see ugliness and evil in each other and the world in which they live. Well, ironically, our past wounds are just like those shards of distorted perceptions of who we truly are as souls, as well as what those wounds that freeze our hearts from seeing the beauty and goodness in others and ourselves. And for people who struggle with intergenerational wounds, who have suffered crimes against humanity, society has often held up its own mirrors of misleading standards, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. But nevertheless, the shards of illusion are intentionally designed to add, let's say, generational distortions to the eyes and hearts of the weak and the wounded. Over then, our minds tell us that what we perceive, albeit very limited and often very hazy, well, it must be true. In severe cases, trauma can be passed down genetically and often attaches itself to our DNA, and often covertly disguises itself as harmful physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual symptoms. And likewise, as intergenerational traumas pass down through society and families, that is, what we carry in our genes and how we are raised, etc., various social systems also galvanize harmful stereotypes and prejudices and injustices and emotional dependence and biases and etc. And therefore, intergenerational trauma is not just limited to how it affects our families, but also it affects all relationships, from the most intimate to the mere acquaintances in our lives. And this realization is powerful because it's a significant aspect of our healing relationships. It occurs that when we are able to understand what has so wounded somebody else and what has so wounded ourselves, that these wounds allow us to continuously act out of that woundedness. And yet at the same time, we expect change. We want to see healing. And that's just impossible because the source of where those actions are coming from have never been healed. And I have to say, from personal experience, I've been there too, that by understanding the background of those who have hurt me, it has allowed me to take the necessary steps closer to forgiving and releasing the burdens of carrying around my wounds any longer. It was a very, very difficult place for me to get to. I'll be the first one to admit it. But when I was able to understand, oh, so that's why. Now I understand. I see the pain that that person has gone through, and I can understand why that person is who, acts the way they do. Doesn't make it right, but it allows me to begin the process of healing. And the same thing is true whenever we forgive one another. Whenever we truly do that, we are, in a sense, telling that other person that we no longer want them to carry around the weight of their wounds. We also want them to be unburdened by any weight of bitterness or unforgiveness or shame or humiliation. We want them to be free as well. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, we're about halfway through the first half hour, you can watch a debate between William F. Buckley and James Baldwin talking about the pain of another person. And it is a great YouTube video. I thoroughly recommend that you watch this. And this is where I get this saying of self-inflicted wounds. And once we realize that where these wounds come from, it does make healing even more possible. And I proposed understanding self-inflicted wounds kind of like the vibration of an echo, that the negative energy of what we send out through our thoughts or our words or our actions will return to us, just like we send out our voice echoing back in our ears when we're in a tunnel or we're in like a hollow cave or something. Or maybe if you were a kid and had like a tin can and you shouted into it and you heard a little echo bouncing back in your ears. But this understanding of where these wounds come from and making it possible to then move one step closer, perhaps, to forgive. This actually has occurred already on, let's say, a much larger scale. Beginning the healing process and forgiving each other is really based on this larger model of restorative justice. Restorative justice really came to the forefront in history after apartheid was abolished in South Africa and a Truth and Reconciliation Commission was established by then President Nelson Mandela. I think it was back in 1994. And the commission was chaired by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And the whole process was to allow victims and survivors to give their testimonies about human rights violations that they suffered under apartheid. I think it was from like 1960 to 1994. And under this model, the perpetrators of such crimes were also allowed to testify about what they had done to other people. And they also were allowed to request amnesty from any civil and criminal prosecution if they could prove that they were following orders at the time. Well, South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission was the first commission to offer amnesty to individuals who fully disclosed in public their involvement in politically motivated crimes. And some of the testimonies of their victims and survivors included killing parents in front of children, killing children in front of parents, raping women, raping children, cutting off hands of victims so they were unable to be fingerprinted or identified later, pulling out mustaches and beards and pulling out teeth and tongues, administering electric shocks all over a person's body, and destruction of property and forced relocations and detainment. All of these stories were just very painful to hear and to recount. But the purpose of this Truth and Reconciliation Commission was twofold. First, it was designed to follow this model of restorative justice, which really focuses on the needs of the victims. It focuses the needs of the community. And it also allows the needs of the offenders to be given a voice. Where is their pain? What happened in their past that allowed them to do such things? And this is a different style, unlike retributive justice, which is really a response to a crime, is proportionate in terms of its punishment. It's a style that was characterized at the time by the Nuremberg trials. But I believe it was Gandhi, I think, who once said that, "I don't want to punish others for the weaknesses that we all possess." And this is true. I mean, he knew the goal of restoration and what it required was listening to and understanding both sides. Both sides have been wounded. The severity depends on who you talk to. But if you go back to that James Baldwin comment, that what happens to a woman who had a cattle prod pushed against her was indeed ghastly. But what happened to the person that allowed him to do that? Something far worse had occurred. This is something that we don't often hear. This is something that we don't often discuss. This is something that often doesn't get reported in the news. I mean, every now and then they'll come out with a feel-good story or maybe a documentary that would get the other side of those who had committed crimes. And when they are given a chance to really consider the impact of what they said and what they did, and they realize just how devastating and gut-wrenching their actions were on somebody else, many are mortified. Many are just so overcome with grief and pain and sorrow that they can't believe that they were capable of doing those things. And they often seek forgiveness. And they often, you know, what can I do? What can I do now to repair? What can I do? I'm so, so sorry. I am so, so brokenhearted. I cannot undo what I have done, but how can I heal? And a lot of times, families often reach out to, let's say, the oppressors, those who have been captured, those who are behind bars, and they form this relationship not out of pity, but a genuine concern that they see something far greater in that person than perhaps that person sees in themselves. The potential to heal, the potential to be whole, the potential to change those wounds into something far, far greater. One of the other things that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission brought out was that governments and institutions that were implicit in the crimes against humanity, that according to international law, they were not permitted to dictate any terms of recovery, or they weren't allowed to dictate any terms of justice or legal resolutions. And what that means is actually, imagine that you have, a person who was raped sitting down with the person who raped him or her, and the perpetrator dictating the terms of, you know, this is what you're going to do in order to heal. You know, and that just doesn't fly, because it's based on that person's need and not so much the victim's need. But the victim's voice certainly needs to be heard. And what does the victim need in order to heal? And so it cannot be dictated by somebody who is, you know, complicit in such crimes. But usually through a mediator, so the two parties, the victim and the perpetrator, are able to sit down and, you know, again, very painfully listening to the wounds of others with the goal of reconciliation, with the goal of restoration, that what is needed here. And there are several positive outcomes, you know, for people who are seeking restorative justice. It's already been shown through studies that it helps reduce recidivism. It also helps reduce post-traumatic stress symptoms. And it also increases this satisfaction that justice has been served. And moreover, unlike retributive justice that determines, you know, the punishment fit the crime kind of mentality, restorative justice focuses on repairing the harm caused by criminal behavior. You know, in an ideal situation, as I said, a mediator helps facilitate this cooperative effort on both sides, and it addresses the wrongdoing and the harm that is caused to others. But this collaboration does not imply that the offender, as I said, of such crimes dictate the terms of, let's say, recovery or healing. Instead, the impact of such crimes committed are seen for the harm that they have caused others, as well as working towards attainable solutions that will bring about lasting reconciliation. And in this way, transformational healing is given an opportunity to take root in all people, all relationships, all communities, past, present, and future. Both sides can find forgiveness. Both sides can find healing. Both sides can find restoration. But it has to begin with someone. And ironically, it just might begin with you. This is going back several decades, but I wonder how many of you out there remember the story of Matthew Shepard. He was a college student who was beaten and left to die near Laramie on the night of, I think it was October the 6th, 1998. Later, after he was found, he was taken to a hospital right outside of Fort Collins, Colorado, where he died from blunt force trauma 6 days later. And Shepard's murder brought national and international attention to hate crime legislation, both on a state and federal level. And eventually, in 2009, Congress passed the Hate Crimes Act. But I bring this up because I don't know if any of you had seen the movie called The Laramie Project. The Laramie Project. I believe it came out, it was an off-Broadway production, but then later they made a movie out of it. Well, I was fortunate enough to see it as an off-Broadway production, and fascinating just how they portrayed this story. Because, you know, it was just a media frenzy when everything was going on. And I'm still convinced that the main character in this off-Broadway production was this little boy who was riding his bike down the dirt road where he found Michael Shepard's body. And throughout this play, this boy would come on stage every now and then. He came on at the beginning, he came in halfway through and that, and he would always have this internal dialogue that he shared with the audience and this internal struggle with why was it he who found Matthew beaten that day? Why him? And after all, he said, I had never been down that road before. I don't know what made me turn down that road. And ultimately, he kept asking, why me? Why me? Why did I have to be the one who found him like that? Why couldn't it have been somebody else? Well, the rest of the play focused on the news media circus and the trial and the anger and the rage in the town and the heartbreaking grief that both sides, both families experienced. And at the end of the play, when everything was over, everyone went back home, the media packed up its bags and went back, and things started to get quiet again, this boy comes out on stage all by himself again with his bike, and he says, I think I now know why it was me who found Matthew. It was to start the healing. Sometimes we are called to be part of the healing process. Sometimes we're called to be part of that. Maybe we don't even know it. But imagine what could happen. Imagine the possibilities if we are more intentional about being the healing process, not just for ourselves, but for others. If we are capable of sending out negative energy from unresolved emotional, physical, psychological, and spiritual wounds, then we can also send out through our thoughts, our words, our actions, positive energy that gives life, healing, and grace, because those things come from the places of woundedness within us that have been healed and transformed. See, perhaps our healing is not just for ourselves. Perhaps it's really meant for somebody else. Sometimes we are called to be part of the healing process. I don't know if you've ever considered yourself part of the healing process or not, but this is something I want to encourage you to consider. Nobody likes to look at their wounds. Nobody wants to go back and like, what happened? Why am I so wounded? And I don't trust people and I don't trust myself. And these are very, very difficult questions to consider. But this begins the healing process. If we want to see the change in this world, if we want to be the change in this world, then we have to first be the healing in this world. My name is Dr. James Houck. You've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. It has been my great pleasure to be with you here, spending this time with you this evening. I invite you to go on the website, look at my information, send me some comments, look at the books that I have written, and I look forward to spending time with you next week when we start looking at change equals loss equals grief. Take care of yourselves, be safe, and behave yourselves. Right? Take care.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio.